Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Picture this, a woman and her husband and daughter, all neatly dressed and coiffed in front of the Eiffel Tower and other Parisian landmarks. The woman is smiling emphatically. The husband and daughter remain expressionless. In fact, they are mannequins, props, dressed up and posed in photographs projecting family togetherness. The family quins, as they are called, appear in a series of vacation snaps, holiday dinner photos, and Christmas cards for a series called Life Once Removed by the photographer and artist Suzanne Heintz. Heintz says it's about spinsterhood in the American way, and her work is the subject of an upcoming feature film called Playing House. Suzanne Heintz, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I am really curious about what got this project off the ground.
Isn't everyone? What started this? Well, it was the pressure to conform. You know, no matter where I turned, I got the question, why aren't you married? You're so cute. You're so fun. I can't understand why you don't have a man. And I just got tired of hearing that. And, you know, one day even my own mother put the question to me, Susie, you know, nobody's perfect out there. You're just going to have to pick somebody if you want to settle down. And that really just hit a trigger with me, and I yelled back at her, and I said, Mom, you know, this is fate we're talking about. It's not like I can go out and make this happen. I can't go out and buy a family. So that just kind of sat with me for a while, and you know, weeks later, I was walking past a retail liquidation outlet center, and I saw these mannequins in the window, and it looked like a perfect family, and I was like, I can go out and buy a family, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I decided to start a photo series on just that subject.
Tell me about some of the situations and poses that you put your family members, which seem to consist mostly of a very handsome man and a young daughter, maybe 10, 12 years old.
Yeah. Actually, she's perpetually 8 years old. But I put them in precarious situations that you really ought not put delicate fiberglass mannequins in. However, you know, I've taken them skiing and I've taken them to Yellowstone and Paris and skating on frozen lakes. I do everything you really shouldn't do with mannequins.
Do they have a backstory? Do they have names? I mean, how
actually,
deeply?
Well, actually, they do have names. My husband is named Chauncey, and I have a seated version and a standing version. So his name is Chauncey A and Chauncey B. And I do have a daughter, and her name is Mary Margaret. Just sounded like the perfect name for a redheaded, freckled girl.
Well, the poses that you put them in, the colors that you're wearing, the fashions all look to be of a certain era. You know, this idealized period of the homemaker. Tell us a little bit about the choices to use that vintage of family life.
Right. I stylized the images to reflect the area of the ideal nuclear family because it's essential to my message. What I'm communicating when I wear vintage clothing is that even in the 21st century, the image of how our lives should look has got its feet firmly planted in the last century. I mean, why haven't we moved on? Traditional lifestyles like that of, you know, Ozzie and Harriet are no longer relevant, yet we stubbornly still cling to that ideal.
Why did you choose to use yourself as a model instead of having someone else in there? What's your role inside of this?
Well, I couldn't have hired anyone to play me. This is all about me. And I, you know, I'm using myself as an instrument to relate a bigger, what would you call it? I mean, it's been termed a free-floating anxiety. You know, the angst that we all feel that nobody's really got their finger on it. You know, we are all somehow subject to expectations that aren't our own. Even if you are married, you get the question, where's the grandkids? Or, you know, say it's in relation to your career. Oh, that's great. You're an attorney. Well, why aren't you partner? We're always focusing on the next step and never really focusing on how good we are in the present moment.
Do you think that's particular to women?
No, I don't think it's particular to women. I think it affects both sexes. But I think women internalize the anxieties more than men. For me personally, it was I started questioning myself when I got all this feedback. You know, I started thinking, well, is there something wrong with me? I don't think so, but it, you know, there's got to be. Everyone else is seeming to point that there's really something wrong. So I think women tend to start blaming themselves instead of just being good with their personal circumstances and embracing their lives for who it's made them.
I'd love to know what's going through your head as you pose. I mean, it's like we've seen these kinds of poses so many times. The woman, you know, pulling the family along in the toboggan. you know, you always look ecstatically happy. And your familykins, they look sort of blank. They're just props. Now that so many people are projecting their lives out on Facebook and showing who they are and what an exciting life they have, it's almost like everybody else is incidental. They're almost like props.
Yes. That is very true. I mean, image crafting has a whole lot to do with this subject. I mean, all of my work has to deal with image versus reality. And I think, you know, because I'm projecting this over-the-top gleam of happiness, I think that speaks to exactly what you're talking about with Facebook. Facebook is today's postcard. And we used to send postcards to people to sort of brag about, look at me, I'm in Paris, you're at home. But we now are, I think, losing ourselves in image projection and making our lives look a little more than they really are. I think it's absolutely essential that we start tapping into not just the image of what a successful life looks like, but the feeling of contentment it's supposed to reflect. You know, we're losing contact with our internal selves, and we're just constantly focusing on how it looks to other people. I think that's the wrong way to go in order to live a happy life.
We're speaking with the artist Suzanne Heintz, who has put together a series of photographs called Life Once Removed. It's her in several different situations with her sort of fake mannequin family that she purchased to set up as props around her as she takes exciting pictures of her absolutely full and fulfilling looking life. And Suzanne, there's some very funny footage that I looked at. You're walking out of an apartment in Paris with your husband perched on your shoulders. and you find this very bemused looking taxi driver and bung your husband in the back. And there are people staring at you. Talk to me a little bit about the logistics of traveling with a mannequin family.
Oh, you have no idea what it's like traveling with a family of mute quadriplegics. They were very difficult to get around. I'd never been abroad before with them, and I didn't realize how difficult it would be to just get them places. I'd always had a car. So I relied on, you know, the kindness of strangers and friends to help me get them around. But there were some times when I just had to go on my own. Well, no cab driver wanted to take me anywhere, so I oftentimes had to either strap them to a hand truck or carry them on my shoulders, which was actually very funny, and it was a great way to, you know, just walk through the streets and gain people's attention, and I got to talk to them and explain what the heck I was doing.
Well, we see in some of the photographs, you can see the reactions of others who are looking at you. There's one, it looks as if you were at either a ballroom dance class or an actual dance. You know, your husband mannequin is wearing a white dinner jacket. You've got a beautiful strapless gown on, and a woman is kind of looking at you. I'm wondering what people say to you when they see you posing with your mannequin family.
Well, I get one of two reactions. Either they raise their eyebrows and walk away, or they laugh hysterically and have to ask what I'm doing. So especially in that scenario, that was at a Valentine's Day ball at a local ballroom here. And there were quite a few people there that were just enthralled with the project and actually tried to cut in and and dance with me and leave Chauncey on the side. So, I mean, it's a really, what would you call it? People are charmed by it when they see this happening. I mean, really, how can you hold a straight face when you see a woman dancing with a mannequin?
But when they ask you, why are you doing this? What do you tell them? Do you have a sort of elevator pitch answer kind of thing?
Oh, I do, actually. I said, you know, my mom was pressuring me to get married, so this is what happens when you force the situation.
Has your mother stopped asking you since?
Yes, she has. Finally. Actually, now she's my biggest fan. It's really funny. But, you know, I think she's sort of accepted my life and now, you know, embraces it just like I do.
Well, now that you've got a little distance, I mean, I am also a woman who's not married, doesn't have children. And I understand what you mean. You know, we choose a life, but there's a little sting of you're not quite normal if this is how you're living your life.
Right.
Did it take you doing this project to overcome that? Has it been cathartic for you to consider yourself in all these fantasy situations when you realize that probably like a lot of women, you're lugging your family around?
Yeah, actually, it is just like that. It is very cathartic. I come from a fairly large family, and we were raised Mormon to boot. And, you know, it was just something I expected to happen in my life. You know, I just sort of assumed that I'd get married with kids. You know, I could have gotten married when I was young, and I didn't. There have been moments in my life where I asked myself, wow, you know, I am not going to have a family when I'm older. Am I okay with that? But as I've sort of acted out this entire scenario over a 14-year period of time, I realized that I do have a family. I just don't have any children of my own. You know, I have a loving companion, yet I don't call him a husband. You know, I have the love and appreciation of my family, as well as the only kind of family that you can choose, friends. You know, when I was young, I assumed that my life would look like everyone else's because that's just what you do. But as I grew up, I found that I had a choice in the matter. I feel as though that this project has actually been the culmination of my life, and I am grateful for this experience. I have never had so much direct impact on so many people's lives. I mean, if I had had my own family, I would probably have had this much impact on 4 people's lives. But now, people in China care what I have to say. And people in Bolivia are writing me about how I've touched their lives and how I've changed their perspective of themselves and their whole life. To me, that's the purpose in living, is to make an impact.
Well, you certainly did it here, Suzanne Hines. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Suzanne Hines, the photographer and artist behind Life Once Removed. You can look through a series of some of these photographs for yourself and watch short film clips about her process and setups. Those short chapters of film are eventually going to be a feature film called Playing House. All of that at wordofmouthradio.org. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll take a radio ride on 2 modes of interior transport, the escalator and the elevator, and how the two have altered the way we think about and navigate our landscapes. Stay with us for that when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Industrial Revolution introduced us to mass production and to the world of cookie-cutter goods, which is perhaps why, when one of those identical items is slightly off, it stands out, for better or for worse. Roman Mars of the 99% Invisible podcast brings us this story of an imperfect product, a music critic, and the sweet, sweet sounds of a broken escalator.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. This is the first joke I ever really noticed as a design joke.
I like an escalator, man, because an escalator can never break. It can only become stairs.
That's Mitch Hedberg.
All right. There would never be an escalator temporarily out of order sign. Only an escalator temporarily stairs. Sorry for the convenience.
Being designed to elegantly deal with the extreme failure case is probably an underappreciated design element, but it really is one of the things that makes an escalator great. Worst case, there's stairs. See how far you get in a broken elevator.
And I bet everyone on this escalator is enjoying that design aspect too. And we're getting our cardio.
That's 99% Invisible Zone, Sam Greenspan walking up an escalator in a metro station in D.C. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, when it became possible for products to be designed just once and then mass-produced, it has been the slight failures and imperfections and the individual wear and tear introduced by human use that transforms a quality mass-produced product into a thing we actually love. Your worn-in blue jeans, your grandmother's iron skillet. The initial design determined its quality, but it's their post-manufacturing imperfections that make them comfortable, that make them lovable, that make them yours. If you think a slightly broken escalator can't be lovable, well, maybe you haven't been paying attention.
An escalator on a DC metro platform is like a fine wine. It's better with age and without any industrial lubricant.
Sam lives in Baltimore now, but he lived in DC for a few years. He said that this sound came to embody the excitement he felt from living in a city.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in one of Florida's most depressing suburbs. I mean, it's just miles and miles of highways and cul-de-sac.
Very nice.
Thank you. So when I moved to D.C., I took public transit everywhere just because I could. The D.C. metro system, it's not the best in the world, but it's pretty good. Although a lot of people do lament the poor condition of the metro's escalators. Some are just flat out broken, and then there are some that work but make these crazy noises, which, you know, annoy a lot of people. But for me, I found that a skronking escalator was like this little trumpeter announcing how awesome it was to live in the city.
It turns out that someone else loves this sound, too.
So this is Chris Richards.
I'm the pop music critic at the Washington Post.
Chris was also in a band called Q and Not You. He wrote a kind of appreciation of the metro escalators for the Post.
We're at the Farragut North Metro Station in Washington, D.C., on the north side of L Street and Connecticut Avenue.
Chris told me that he had never really noticed the sound that the escalators made until one day when he was on a bit of a free jazz kick.
Having my ear trained for those sort of breath on brass kind of sounds, I think maybe turning the corner to come down the escalators one day, I thought, oh, there's a saxophone player playing at the bottom of the metro. But it wasn't that at all. It's just the escalators kind of like wonking and screeching away. Maybe they were, I don't know if they were always this loud.
On the escalator, there's a plastic element on the side of each step that keeps it from rubbing against the metal siding. A lubricant keeps it all running smoothly. But when it rains or snows, the lubrication wears off.
So what you're hearing when you hear these kind of like moaning squawks is the steel stairs sort of rubbing up and chafing against that plastic element when it's gotten a little too dry. Kind of like a beautiful serendipitous aftershock of the wear and tear that these escalators are facing. It sounds like music.
And like any good music critic, Chris started classifying the different styles of metro escalator. So here at Farragut North, the escalators might sound like
whales mating or something like that.
Whereas the escalator at U Street
kind of sounded like Indian drone music.
And at Columbia Heights,
an aviary of chrome-throated ravens taunting you as you descend into your workday.
We understand that we could be over-romanticizing a skronking and squeaking escalator.
You can talk all day about appreciating the ambient soundscape around you and get really into aestheticized ways of listening. Chris Richards was big on this, by the way. But you could also just as easily say, you know, hey, this is all noise.
You know, I think it's all really in the ear of the beholder, so.
Yeah, it is totally understandable that people wouldn't appreciate a screeching escalator. Chris actually told me that when he called up Metro for his story, their PR people didn't believe him. They thought he was writing some big expose about escalator failure.
Quite the opposite, really. I was trying to say, you know, even though these things are a little bit beat down, this is a wonderful little residual bonus, I guess.
My point of view is if you're going to be subjected to some kind of sensory experience of which you have no control every single day, then it's to your benefit. It's, you know, why not try to enjoy something? Because there's enough things in life to be stressed out about.
As much as people complain about all the sounds that cities make and all the noises that cities make, I think those noises define it and, you know, really become our environment. The sound can be an irritation or it can be information.
Chris got me hoping the escalators never get fixed. Except the ones that just straight up don't work. The escalator at the Wheaton Stop, it is the longest escalator in the Western Hemisphere. It takes 3 minutes to ride to the top when it's working.
Let's hope that the Wheaton escalator doesn't conveniently become stairs anytime soon. 99% Invisible was produced this week by our intern Sam Greenspan and me, Roman Mars. It was adapted from an episode of Sam's podcast, Whisper Cities, a show about overlooked places and the people who find them. Find out more at whispercities.org.
That's Roman Mars, host and producer of the design and architecture podcast, 99% Invisible. All right, then, from escalators, we are going to move on up quickly. Invented in the mid-19th century, the elevator dramatically altered America's urban and social landscapes. We're going to examine life in a post-lift world when word of mouth continues. Going up after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
This is the Great Glass Wonkavator.
It's an elevator.
It's a Wonkavator.
From Willy Wonka's glass contraption to the blood-filled nightmare from The Shining, the elevator has played a pivotal role in scenes from film and literature, surprisingly given its compact size. But as a social space, the elevator really is unlike any other. Depending on the context, it can be intimate or claustrophobic or frightening or comic or embarrassing or sexy. Putting aside our modern perceptions of the elevator, let us imagine how these cramped cabins would have seemed to a person stepping inside one for the very first time in the mid to late 19th century. Andreas Bernard is a professor of cultural studies at the Leiphana University in Lüneburg. His new book is called Lifted, A Cultural History of the Elevator, and joins us now on the line. Hello, Andreas.
Hello, Virginia.
Let's talk about how they fit into the elevator itself, fit into the social landscape at the time. What kind of buildings were outfitted with elevators? Obviously, tall ones.
Yeah, you could say that the condition of possibility for high-rise buildings in the middle of the 19th century was the elevator. You can have an example, the most prominent example, New York City. Manhattan was already pretty crowded around 1850. For example, the Wall Street thought about going to Brooklyn because there was not much space anymore in the island of Manhattan. And you could not build higher buildings than 4 or 5 stories because no one wanted to go upstairs so many stories. And so the elevator basically in the 1850s was the reason that Manhattan could still grow vertically.
And it also changed the social hierarchy. Back in the day, having an apartment at the top of the stairs was a lot less desirable than, you know, because you had to climb, right?
Absolutely. For my book, I studied 20 or 30 volumes of traveling books with hotel recommendations in Europe and the U.S., and you could always say until the 1880s, 1890s, the higher you got, the cheaper the rooms were. Hmm. And on the other hand, the apartment buildings in Europe, you had this famous bel étage, the first floor,
right,
which were the most exciting and the most expensive flats, and under the roof there were the, in France, the chambre de bonne, the rooms for the maids, or you had the attic, which was a very poor space. And you can tell that within a very short time, let's say between 1880 and 1920, everything switched. And in the early 20th century, you then had the penthouse or the roof gardens or the executive top floor. And I think the elevator was responsible for this revolutionary of the vertical structure of high-rise buildings.
Getting into the elevator itself, it's a strange social space. You know, people don't know whether to say hello to each other, talk to each other, or are you supposed to remain silent. How did that begin?
Yeah, it's an absolutely strange space. And, you know, it's still, after 150 years, it's a strange space. But in the second half of the 19th century, when the elevator was invented in apartment buildings or hotels, people could not tell if it's a vehicle or if it's just a space. And gentlemen, they were not sure if they should leave their hat open when they came into an elevator or if they should put it down Because in a normal room, they would have kept it on the head, and in a means of transportation like a coach, they would have put it down. And you could also tell when you saw how the early elevators were furnished, because they were furnished like a living room. Maybe you have seen in cities like Vienna or Budapest, you still have those old elevators which are furnished with a chandelier on the ceiling and with a sofa on the ground. So there was this irritation. What is an elevator? Is it really a means of transportation, or is it a living room which moves upward and downward?
But something interesting happens inside of elevators. Maybe for some people it's the fear of getting stuck or the smallness of the space. You call it a secular confessional. What do you mean by that, Andreas?
Yeah, and you know, it was during the research for the book, I watched tons of Hollywood movies because I was in search of movies which were located in elevators or which were certain scenes played in an elevator. And I always made the experience that in movies, elevators get stuck. And at the same time, I read some statistics, some technical statistics, that in real life, elevators, since a couple of decades, don't get stuck anymore because they are so safe. So there's a kind of tendency that in movies, you want to have an elevator stuck. Why is this the case? The moment where people get stuck in an elevator together is always a moment of truth. You know, let's say a couple which had hidden secrets, they get stuck together and they confess it. The room, the space which is so narrow and which is so closed, is like a real confessional, a space where you're forced to say the truth.
Andreas Bernard is with us. He's author of a new book called Lifted. It's a cultural history of the elevator. You know, we all know elevators so well, it seems a little mundane. So I'm curious about why you wanted to research the history of the elevator.
Maybe two reasons. One reason for research, it was that at the beginning I figured out that a lot of TV commercials played in an elevator at the same time. So maybe 10 years ago, if you turned on the TV, there were 10 or 12 or 14 TV commercials at the same times which were located in an elevator. And I asked myself, why is that the case? And then I figured out that the products, they had all to do with intimacy, you know, shampoo for dandruffs or chewing gum or washing powder. And I found out that an elevator, because it's so dense and so hermetic, is kind of a laboratory for products. If you see in an elevator, if somebody has dandruffs or if somebody has a bad smell in the mouth, then you can tell that this product will really help to change that. So that was my first impact as a researcher. And on the other hand, I would say that there is maybe kind of a biographical background, because my parents grew up in Vienna, and as a child I went to them to their old apartment building in Vienna, and they really had this old elevator in the house from maybe 1880, where you still had to put in a coin, you know, to get it moving, and it still was furnished with a chandelier and a couch. And so maybe I had a hidden impact from this old memory. So I think there were those two reasons maybe to get interested in the elevator.
Andreas Bernard, professor of cultural studies at Leifuna University in Lüneburg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Andreas's new book is called Lifted, A Cultural History of the Elevator. You can learn more about the book and check out a list of some of our favorite elevator scenes from TV and film. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is thought to be the most well-known and frequently sung song in the world. Anecdotally, it could also be the most poorly sung song of all time.
Happy birthday, dear
Ouch. Happy Birthday, a song created for kids that is revived annually pretty much until you die. It is automatic. Co-workers, family members, even strangers sing it if in the vicinity when the tune begins. The Happy Birthday song has been around since 1893, and guess what? anyone who sings it is supposed to pay royalties to its publisher. Here with more on the song's history is Scott Kies, senior reporter for Think Progress. He wrote the article, Why We Should Stop Singing Happy Birthday, for Pacific Standard Magazine. Scott, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on, Virginia. I appreciate it.
Well, I guess from the name of your article, I pretty much know where you stand on the Happy Birthday song.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you, I was at a coworker's birthday party just a few weeks ago, and, you know, it was really nice affair. It was after work, and a couple people brought in some nice craft beers and you know, brought him in, told him it was a meeting. He walked in and, oh, you know, surprise, happy birthday. It was really nice and fun until all of a sudden one of our coworkers, Lauren, decided to ask those five dreaded words, should we sing happy birthday? And, you know, everybody in the group froze because nobody wants to be that curmudgeon who says, you know, no, let's not sing Josh happy birthday. And so, you know, nobody can be the voice of reason here. And so while that idea is just floating up there, all of a sudden Lauren has to buckle under the weight of her own suggestion and start singing out the first few words, you know, happy birthday. And then all of a sudden we're all faced with the choice. Do we let her sing on her own, in which case she has to either trail off after one verse or sing the entire thing by herself, or do we all go ahead and join her, in which case we all have to go ahead and try to harmonize it and probably do it pretty poorly, which we ultimately ended up doing.
Well, before we get into your proposed band, let's go back to the birth of the birthday song, 1893. You looked into where it came from. Tell us more.
Yeah, so, you know, the history of the Happy Birthday song is actually kind of one that goes way back, and there's actually surprising mystery about it, considering the fact that, like you mentioned, it's cited as the best known and most frequently sung song in the entire world. We know for sure where the tune came from. It is an 1893 song composed by two kindergarten teachers from Kentucky named Patty and Mildred Hill, who originally wrote a song called Good Morning to All. They were kindergarten teachers during the day, but then at night they kind of moonlighted as songwriters, composers. They liked to try to come up with songs that they thought their students would be able to harmonize and enjoy. And
Do you know the words to Good Morning to All?
Yeah, so it's similarly simple to Happy Birthday. It's Good Morning to All, Good Morning to All, Good Morning, Dear Children, Good Morning to All. You can see where Happy Birthday comes from.
Well, any theories on who substituted the Happy Birthday lyrics? Was it Mildred and Patty Hill?
Well, so that's where the mystery comes from. Somewhere in the next two or three decades, the song went from just Good Morning to All to all of a sudden being sung at birthday parties with these new lyrics that, you know, the lyrics that we know today of Happy Birthday. But it's not really clear who first came up with those Happy Birthday words. There's been a professor, Robert Brownice, at George Washington University, who has written, you know, extensive studies and looking into where the origins of the song comes from. And all he's been able to determine is that we're not exactly sure who wrote them, but it's almost for sure that it was not the Hill sisters.
Mm-hmm. Well, although no one can prove that the Hill sisters wrote those lyrics, the copyright has been fought for since the Hill family. In fact, it was caught up in a pretty famous battle back in 1934. Can you give us that story?
Sure. So you know, it became more and more popular in the early 20th century. In 1934, Irving Berlin had written a Broadway musical called As Thousands Cheer that used the birthday song in it. Now, a sister of Patty and Mildred Hill, one of whom had passed away by this point, actually ended up suing Irving Berlin for unauthorized use of the song, claiming that her family owned the rights to it. That case ended up getting dismissed, but Jessica Hill, the third sister, ended up working with a music publisher to copyright the song the next year, I believe, in 1935. And this copyright is actually still in effect today, almost 80 years later. It's still under copyright and generating millions in licensing fees from its popularity.
Millions? Who pays to use the Happy Birthday song?
Well, your listeners don't have to worry that they might be footed with a bill at their next kid's birthday party, thankfully. But if there's a TV show, a movie, you know, a restaurant chain, anything on down the line, some business that uses the Happy Birthday song is subject to copyright fees, just as they would be with any other song that's copyrighted today by, you know, Lady Gaga or whoever. So this is why, for instance, if next time one of your listeners goes to Red Robin or Joe's Crab Shack or a place like that, they won't be singing the Happy Birthday song. These restaurant chains come up with their own unique takes on the birthday song. They have their own version of it in order to try to avoid those licensing fees. But at the same time, you know, there are businesses and whatnot that will just go ahead and pay for the licensing fee. And it's estimated that in total, the Happy Birthday song generates about $2 million each year in licensing fees.
Wowie. We're speaking with Scott Kai, senior reporter for Think Progress. He wrote the article and is starting the campaign, Why We Should Stop Singing Happy Birthday. The article was in Pacific Standard. $2 million. Scott, how did this song evolve from a little Kentucky backwoods kindergarten ditty into such a powerhouse?
You know, it's a fascinating, fascinating, perfect storm of factors that ended up resulting in the Happy Birthday song being the phenomenon that we know it today. You know, back in the 1800s, there was really no such thing as a birthday party. Birthdays just didn't have the same grandeur and excitement that they do today. But a number of things started to develop around the middle of the 19th century. For instance, birthday cakes arose in the 1840s, and the concept of birthday parties among kids of the same age started a little bit later in the 1800s. Before that, birthday parties, even for kids, tended to be affairs for adults, where kids were essentially showing how good their manners were or how, you know, upstanding and involved a citizen they were. But, you know, as society developed, as people started to get a little bit wealthier and we started to develop a little bit more child-oriented view of adolescence, birthday parties rose too as a result. By the early 20th century or so, the kind of modern birthday party really started to take hold, you know, with birthday cakes, with that was celebrating the child, that had the child's friends over. And so, you know, we had all the kind of prerequisites that we would need for something like the birthday song to take hold, just starting to take shape right as the birthday song was invented in the early 20th century.
Okay, so you, early in the 21st century, propose that we should stop singing Happy Birthday. Scott Kies, make your case.
That's right. You know, it's my case is, it boils down to two very simple points. One, nobody likes singing it. And two, nobody likes having it sung to them. Now, you know, I will make a slight exception here that I think we should continue singing Happy Birthday to kids because, you know, it is fun when you're a kid to feel like celebrated in the center of attention. But I think once we get to about age 14 or so, you know, this is right around kids are in middle school. They want to assert their independence. They want to show that they're no longer just a young kid anymore. I think right about then is the right time to let this person have their own autonomy and dignity and stop subjecting them to the awkwardness of being publicly sung to.
So that's from the celebrant's perspective. How about the singers?
Exactly. Well, so the problem with the way that we sing Happy Birthday, especially, you know, in an office or to other at adult birthday parties, for one, very few among us are actually good singers. And so when we try to combine the fact that we're not good singers, we're not in a particularly forgiving acoustic setting, you know, we're not singing in the shower or the Kennedy Center or anything like that, and we're not singing with a group that has practiced together or has any harmony, it tends to come out like the clip that you played at the beginning of the segment where it sounds, frankly, pretty bad. So, you know, I propose that we all just go ahead and cut the charade and say, you know, after we turn 14, let's still celebrate people's birthdays, but let's go ahead and not sing them the happy birthday and see if they enjoy it more. I suspect they will.
Scott, are people going to know what to do at your next birthday party? They all on notice?
You know, I'll tell you, even this morning, there was someone had a birthday and I heard the birthday song being sung, and my coworker's looking at me like, Scott, better go lay down the law on them, you know, better go tell them. I'm very curious to see what happens next December when my birthday rolls around.
Well, we will be sure not to sing this song for you. We thank you so much for your time today.
It was great to be with you, Virginia. Thanks.
Scott Keyes is senior reporter for Think Progress, who wrote the article, Why We Should Stop Singing Happy Birthday, for Pacific Standard Magazine. You'll find a link to read it for yourself and maybe join his campaign at wordofmouthradio.org. After more than 100 years of regular use, maybe the problem has less to do with the tradition of celebratory singing as the song itself. Given that happy birthday consists of just about 5 words, it couldn't be too hard to come up with something catchy or fresh, an alternative, could it? To find out, NHPR's All Things Considered host Brady Carlson joined producers Maureen McMurray and Taylor Quimby in the studio.
So here's what I'm thinking.
Lay it on us.
A birthday song has to have a few basic elements. It's got to be pretty simple. It in some way needs to celebrate a birthday.
Yes. It needs to be personalized.
And it needs to, exactly, it needs to be customizable.
No mention of age.
Yeah.
No mention of how far you've gotten along, that you've lived so bloody long.
No big deal. Another year went by.
And right? You haven't accomplished all those things you set off to accomplish.
Oh. No.
Do you think there should be 2 separate songs, one for kids and one for adults?
No.
So just so it has to be.
It has to be universal. You were born in 1964. You were born.
Some of those chain restaurant birthday songs basically aren't songs at all. They're just chants, and it's incredibly unnerving. The older I get, the more weirded out I get about people chanting things when they come toward me.
Maybe the focus should – maybe we should change the focus to the mom.
Maybe the customizable part is how long the mother was in labor.
You took 15 hours. You took 15 hours.
One of the songs that really struck me that I listened to before we sat down to talk was the song Mr. Rogers sang on his show to
what
you.
What was his?
Happy birthday, dear friend.
Lisa, it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Lisa.
Sounds so much smoother when the two of you were singing along.
Tick, tock, tick.
Oh, that's
tock,
good.
Tick, tock.
There
tick,
goes another
tock,
year for tick, Cassandra.
Tock,
she's
tick,
getting older.
Tick, tock. I actually like this. I actually like
I
this.
I do. That's
you
good.
Know what? Maybe so. Okay, so maybe tock. The thing about that happy birthday song is. So awkward because we're not acknowledging what we all truly feel about. So maybe we should commit to going dark.
You need a song that acknowledges the
like
elephant
the
in the room.
Tick,
tick, tock, tick.
You now
tock,
are 78.
Tick, tock,
I hope
tick,
you've got your living
tock,
will
tick,
in place.
That's just so terrible.
Wait, so does it start with 1 year older, 1 year wiser? Does it go
That's
1 year older? 1 year wiser. Let's all hope you don't turn into a miser, Cassandra.
Maybe we don't even mention the age. I don't know. Maybe
yeah.
It's 1 year older, 1 year wiser. It's your special day.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yay.
Tick, tock, tick, tock. 1 year
tick,
older,
tick,
1 year
tock,
wiser.
Tick,
it's your special
tock,
day.
Tick, yay.
That's it.
We did
That's
it.
That's it.
All right. High fives, everybody.
Nice.
Woo.
Yeah.
Well, so what do you think? Will our version of the happy birthday song endure the test of time? Would it be more, less, or equally painful to sing than that regular happy birthday song? Let us know what you think on our Facebook page at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Or do you think you can compose a better version? If so, we'd love to hear it. We have several ways you can share your happy birthday song. If you're a web person, post it on our Facebook page. Or if it's easier, simply pick up the phone and sing it to us on our listener line, 603-223-2448. Step-by-step instructions, along with our email address and that phone number, all at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us tomorrow at 2 for more Word of Mouth, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.